Welcome to African American Conservative, your source for political news and commentary from a cultural and right-of-center perspective. African American Conservative, the soul of the conservative movement.
Today's sponsor is audibletrial.com. They have more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/AACONS. That's www.audibletrial.com/AACONS. Kimberly Strassel is a member of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. Since 2007, she has written the Potomac Watch column and has worked for the Wall Street Journal in Brussels, London, and New York. An Oregon native, Ms. Strassel is a graduate of Princeton University and lives in Virginia with her three children. Her new book is entitled The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. Welcome to the show, Kim.
It's so great to be here.
One of the words you use most often in your book is Orwellian, and clearly this word resonates with anyone who's been watching the news lately. We've recently seen people beaten in the streets for attending a Trump rally in San Jose. Mozilla CEO Brendan Eich and Professor John McAdams of Marquette University were both fired for expressing their support of traditional marriage. Former pitcher Curt Schilling was fired from ESPN for questioning the right of the transgendered to use opposite-sex restrooms. Football great Herschel Walker is reportedly being blacklisted from speaking gigs because he supports Donald Trump. Mayors are still calling for a boycott of Chick-fil-A, and progressive pundits, academics, and even some politicos like Robert Kennedy are calling for the arrest of those who are skeptical of climate change. Georgetown University law professor Randy Barnett said on our show recently that we are in the most intolerant age of his lifetime, an era in which the First Amendment is regularly violated, in spirit if not in letter. Do you share Professor Barnett's assessment that we are in an age of intolerance, and is this what inspired you to write The Intimidation Game?
Oh, absolutely. And of all those things that you mentioned, they're all terrible. But there is something insidious in particular about government silencing speech. And a lot of what I wrote about in the book is focused on that. It's when elected officials, and in this case Democratic officials, are sicking the bureaucratic state on their opponents to send the message that if they speak out, there will be ramifications. Or when liberal prosecutors go after conservative organizations to send the message that if they take part in elections, their lives will become hell. But all of those examples that you cited are part of the intimidation game, and it's a tactic that these days is widespread across the left. Its tactics are replicated over and over, and often is done in conjunction with many different groups together that are connected.
Speaking of Orwellian, one of the most profound passages from 1984 is, quote, "The party seeks power entirely for its own sake. We are not interested in the good of others. We are interested solely in power, pure power," end quote. One gets the impression that these words could have been spoken by President Obama's ally, Bob Bauer, whom you give credit for laying, quote, "the groundwork for an entire political movement to come," end quote. What role did Mr. Bauer have in establishing the intimidation game?
So Bob Bauer is Barack Obama's campaign lawyer, was in 2008 and again in 2012, and he's an election law expert. And I do give him some credit for the tactics of this because he first, and this is, I think, very interesting because it gets to your PowerPoint, this is not necessarily about ideology, this is about power. And Bob Bauer used these tactics the first time on Hillary Clinton. When she was running against Barack Obama in the 2008 primary, there was a super PAC who was supporting her, and Mr. Bauer threatened, and this was one of the first times this had ever happened, to sic the Justice Department on this super PAC, to sic the Federal Election Commission on it, to sic the IRS on them, and not just on the group itself, but on its donors. And he said this publicly, and it was clearly designed to intimidate people out of getting money to that super PAC, and the money indeed dried up not long after he made those threats. So he began against actually a fellow Democrat, but it proved so successful he ended up using similar tactics against groups that then were supporting John McCain in the general election in 2008. And many other organizations witnessed this and decided to start doing it themselves.
One of the most interesting points in the intimidation game focuses upon a hot topic in recent political conversation, which is the ability or right to donate money to campaigns anonymously. The practice is bemoaned by those in both parties as a corrupting influence on politics, especially as it relates to what is being called dark money, or the ability to anonymously give unlimited donations to nonprofit organizations which seek to influence political elections. You, in your book, reference Judge Clarence Thomas in saying, quote, "Government has a long and inglorious history of harassment. One reason why the country has an equally long and glorious tradition of anonymous speech," end quote. Would you share with us one of the examples you provided in the intimidation game, which illustrates the need for anonymity in political speech as a protection against harassment?
Yeah, one that ought to scare everyone, because I think that some people think that these tactics and the things that happen, the intimidation, only happens to, you know, political groups. Groups are out there in the cut and thrust of it, and they might even think that as a result that's just how politics works and it's okay. But in fact, the left is now using these tactics on average citizens. And one of the most scary examples in the book were people out in California when they were supporting Prop 8, which was in favor of traditional marriage. The people who gave money to Prop 8, of course, their donations were disclosed. And the activists out in the state who opposed them took those names, they put them on a searchable, walkable map so that you could actually go neighborhood by neighborhood and target your, quote, opponents. The people who were on that list had their cars keyed. They had their windows broken. They had threatening messages left on their home and work voicemails and sent to them over the internet. They were threatened in many different ways. They had flash mobs come out and protest their small businesses, standing in front of the doors refusing to let customers come in. Some of them even lost their jobs, and you mentioned the most prominent of them, Brendan Eich, the former CEO of Mozilla. But many, many other people did as well, too. And I think that this is the example of why we actually do need to rethink disclosure in this country. The left likes to talk about dark money, and the leaders of the left like to suggest that it's very corrupting. In fact, just to put it in perspective, we spent about $7 billion in 2012 on elections in this country. About 2 to 3% of that, 3 to 4% of that is what they call dark money. What I call, that my word for that money is anonymous and protected money, because we know what happens when these names come out sometimes. And the leaders out there who are claiming that dark money is a problem, they don't really care about that concept so much because they use it themselves. The real reason that they want disclosure is that they have more names, so that more things like what in California happened.
Kim, do you favor any sort of campaign donation restriction, especially regarding donations from corporations, nonprofits, and other groups or billionaires like the Koch brothers and Tom Steyer? If so, what restrictions would you favor?
Definitely no. I do not want restrictions on how much people can give, because here's the thing that I think people forget. You know, the left has done such a good job of scaring us all that money and politics is somehow corrupting. In fact, money is a proxy for speech. Money enables speech. So the more money you have out there, the more speech you have. And, you know, some people go, no, that's hogwash. But think of it this way. If you said that you wanted to run for president, and I told you, great, but you can only have $50 to do it, I think we would both agree that you probably wouldn't be very effective at getting your message out across the nation. So once you accept that, then you've accepted the premise that money enables speech. And, you know, a lot of people also forget, too, that, you know, the people who really benefit from any from restrictions on money and spending are incumbents, the status quo, the establishment, because they're the ones that have a free megaphone to get their own message out. The only way that other people can do it is to come together, band together sometimes, and put together donations to somehow have their own voice in election and support candidates that are new and trying to be heard. You know, the founders themselves, with the reason they wanted the First Amendment is to encourage debate. They wanted to set faction upon faction, and they felt that that was the best way forward in a democracy. So to my mind, having more money is a way to make sure that that happens.
The intimidation game gives the reader a thorough history of the IRS gate saga, as well as reminds us why so many of us hate lawyers. Besides Bob Bauer and, of course, Lois Lerner, we're introduced to another Washington attorney named William Wilkins. Who is he? And if he is not the smoking gun that proves the Obama White House was both involved and helped coordinate IRS gate, then is he at least a warm pistol?
Well, William Wilkins definitely deserves some more scrutiny. He is a general counsel of the IRS. Interestingly, he was there all during the time that the IRS targeting happened, and interestingly, he is there still. I want to be clear. I'd like to think that this book is the first real whole tale of what happened at the IRS that we know. The White House continues to peddle this line that, you know, it was just a couple of line agents out in Cincinnati and they didn't understand the law and it was all a big mistake. That is just totally untrue. We have had many investigations. We have the answers now. We know how this was inspired. We know who did it. We know that it was run out of Washington. We know that it was done for partisan and ideological reasons. And we know also that there was a giant cover-up afterward to try to make it sound like it wasn't as bad as it actually was. And from my mind, I think this is one of the worst abuses of government power in absolute decades.
Yes.
But William Wilkins, interestingly, and I want to be clear, all your listeners, there is no smoking gun. That's one thing that I don't have in there. We don't really know what William Wilkins' role is because, by the way, as general counsel, all of his information is protected. But he did go in, and when he talked, he could not recall much of anything. And, you know, also he's just one of those guys that it's interesting that he's still there today. And if you were of a mind to believe that the Obama administration knew it had something that had to hide at the IRS, that would be one reason for keeping a political appointee because, by the way, he's one of only two political appointees at the IRS in his place.
If nothing else, President Obama has proven himself to be a master at being the bully behind the bully pulpit, and he has displayed his ability in his 2010 State of the Union address, in which he, with most members of the House, Senate, and Supreme Court in audience, remarked on the court's Citizens United decision, claiming that, quote, last week the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections, end quote. President Obama likely knew the remark was untrue. Even the unusually Obama-friendly site PolitiFact ranked the remark as mostly false. Was this remark part of a bullying campaign to further silence free speech, in your view?
It was the start of it. You know, this whole intimidation game, it's unusual in that it can actually almost be traced to one day, and that day would be January 21st, 2010, when the Supreme Court did issue its Citizens United ruling. And that ruling, of course, allowed all kinds of actors who had pretty much been exiled from politics back into the Democratic sphere. It was a great day. But the Democrats, they had become to rely very heavily on these speech laws, otherwise known as campaign finance laws, to keep their opponents quiet. Once the court made that ruling, they knew they had a problem, especially because this was 2010 and the midterms were coming, and they knew that they were in electoral trouble. So they made a decision, and you can actually go. They wrote about it at the time, okay, and they said, if we can't outright bar our opponents from taking part in elections anymore, we're going to do the next best thing. We're going to threaten and humiliate and harass them and make them think twice before they take part. And this was Barack Obama beginning to do that. And it's the beginning, by the way, the pistol shot, the starting gun for the IRS targeting scandal. because the president ensued in going for the next months all the way through November out on the stump saying again and again what he said at that State of the Union. There are all these shadowy nonprofits and groups out there. We don't know who's funding them. They might be funded illegally. He knew that wasn't true. He knew that they were Tea Party groups of good, honest conservatives who were interested in the future of this country. But he was blowing a dog whistle to the IRS. He was saying, somebody needs to do something about this. And you had elected Democrats in the Senate and the House also writing letters to the IRS demanding they do something. And we know from the emails that we have in the IRS that that bureaucracy was ready and willing to act and acted for that reason.
Kim, there are fewer, clearer examples of the liberal effort to silence free speech than the bullying campaign against the Koch brothers. Would you take us through how the Kochs became the boogeyman for the left?
Look, I think the reason that the Koch brothers are so reviled is because they're, in fact, the opposite of what the left calls them. And they talk about how they are billionaires who can control elections and everything, which is, of course, nonsense. And it also doesn't take into account that the left has plenty of billionaires on their own that spend lots and lots of money in elections, and they're perfectly fine with that. My top example is Tom Steyer, the environmentalist billionaire who spent tens of millions of dollars in the last midterm trying to get Democrats elected. But the reason they don't like the Kochs is because the Kochs are the opposite. The Kochs enable grassroots movements in the United States. For instance, one of the organizations that they support is called Americans for Prosperity. And this is a group that has chapters across the United States, millions of members, and they mobilize and they end up calling their congressmen, their local representatives, and getting things done. At a local level, they're very effective, and they're very effective in elections too. And the left can't stand this kind of grassroots activism because it does work. So this is why they dislike him. And what they wanted is they wanted someone that they could paste on the front of their campaign to make it sound like this money was dark and you couldn't see it and that there was corruption. And so they made them the poster boy of it. And in some really astounding ways, I mean, Harry Reid has been down to the well of the Senate so many times to call the Koch brothers horrible things, unpatriotic, un-American, I mean, just because they take an interest in democracy.
Coincidentally, about the time we at ACON learned we would be interviewing you for your book, The Intimidation Game, one of our founders was temporarily banned from Facebook due to the Islam's Jihad Against Homosexuals editorial published by your friends at the Wall Street Journal. We posted it on our Facebook page, then the ban came. What is a chilling note to this is that increasingly more of how we as a people communicate political opinion is over social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter that are actually private companies controlled by liberals. And as such, can easily decide that a conservative group or message along the lines of abortion is murder, or even a link to a Wall Street Journal article is unwelcome. Do you share this concern for the vulnerability of conservative viewpoints in today's age of social media?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think that there's any question. Look, now, I mean, the left will say conservatives have their own outlets. They talk about talk radio, and they talk about some stations on TV and cable. But the reality is that a lot of the mainstream outlets, like what you're talking about, yes, there is a dominance of a liberal viewpoint there. And over social media, this is something that is concerning very much. I mean, we should be encouraging more free speech. And I think this gets to the other half of the intimidation game. I mean, I describe how these groups and government officials are attempting to silence people. But why are they doing that? And, of course, it's because it's all about controlling information. And so one side of that is trying to get your opposition to shut up, but the other side is controlling the outflow of information. And of course, we saw that in dramatic detail last week when the Obama administration censored part of the transcript from the shooting down in Orlando. And we've seen it when they edit clips from State Department press briefings because they don't want people to see some of the questions. And we see it in the spin that they put out about things about, like, for instance, veterans and supposedly what happened at the IRS or what happened at the Veterans Affairs Administration when they had those terrible waiting lists. It's all about spinning and control and making sure that people only hear the message they want to hear.
What was particularly concerning about this event was that it happened mere weeks after the summit at Facebook with conservative leaders to assuage concerns about any sort of censoring by Facebook.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm curious to know how they – did they say anything to you guys when you went and asked about him being banned?
Well, it got overturned shortly, and all they said was it was a mistake.
Well, you know, let's hope that there
– Yeah.
So let's hope that there is actual progress being made here. But I think this is another aspect of the book, The Intimidation Game, is that when you see stuff, people need to speak out. They need to make an issue out of it because, I mean, one of the problems, too, is I think a lot of people don't even understand for a while that they're being intimidated or, they, you know, it takes a while to put it together. One of the women I talk about in the book is Catherine Engelbrecht, and she runs an organization called True the Vote. And it's a, you know, voting integrity project. They look at making sure that, you know, ballots are valid and voters are valid, really, voter rolls. The left hates her organization. And years ago, they started turning her into a campaign against her. And as Catherine was going along dealing with all of her other problems, because, by the way, she was among those who could not get her nonprofit status with the IRS, she was getting visited on a sort of regular, steady stream of federal agencies that suddenly were investigating or auditing her business. Her home family business, you know, and she admits to me in the book that it took her a while to realize that, you know, this wasn't a coincidence. And then even when she started to, she wondered if she were crazy. And she finally sort of went to her lawyer and she goes, I don't want to sound as though I'm, you know, the sort of person that hears black helicopters, but does this strike you as weird? And her lawyer was just appalled. She was like, you should have talked about it. You should have said something about this. Because, of course, you know, when you started to add up the sheer number, there was no question her name was on a list somewhere.
That's exactly right. We wonder if we hadn't approached Facebook, how long this ban would have been. We just got this not anonymous note, but just this vague general note with the link to the article, no date set for how long the ban would occur, nothing. And if we had not challenged it, I don't think it would have gotten overturned so quickly. So you're right. You gotta speak
up. Yeah, we have to be vigilant. And you know, an example of how this doesn't work or how it works badly is I talk about a number of companies, and they have also been targeted for taking part in elections. And by the way, we need companies to be in elections. They are the voice of millions of workers, and corporate success depends on good business climates, low taxation rates, smaller state, and they need to be as part of that debate. They represent those workers every bit as much as unions do, who obviously participate in elections. But the left doesn't want them out there for that reason, and so they attack them frequently. And the problem with companies is that they too often roll over. And one of the things that comes out in The Intimidation Game, this book, is that the more you roll over, the more you just set yourself up to be attacked again.
That's right. As a sort of postscript to The Intimidation Game, Friday, three days ago as we record this, the DNC has called for the Justice Department to investigate fossil fuel companies for, quote, misleading the public and their shareholders about the danger of climate change, end quote. This action reminded many of us of one of your recent columns for the Wall Street Journal, in which you examined the crusade from several state attorney generals against Exxon for climate denial, stating, quote, what these liberal prosecutors really want is to shut down a universe of their most hated ideological opponents, end quote. Are we beginning to see a new wave of liberal intimidation tactics in which those who oppose them on climate change or gun control or abortion and so on may find themselves facing criminal charges?
Oh, we've already seen it. The book has a number of chapters on what happened in Wisconsin. in which a liberal prosecutor attempted to prosecute 30 conservative groups who had supported Scott Walker's reform, and that had to go all the way to the state Supreme Court before it got shut down. But this Exxon thing is a perfect example of the intimidation game, and it's a pity it came after the book was done being written, so I didn't get it in there. But, you know, this is an example. These are people who they are out investing Exxon on absolutely ludicrous grounds, the argument that, you know, because they once had science, it now doesn't fit with the liberal mindset on climate change, that somehow they defrauded shareholders and or should be brought up on racketeering charges. But really what these guys are after, and they let the bag out, they let the cat out of the bag, was when the Virgin Islands Attorney General sent a subpoena not just to Exxon but to this array of 100 conservative groups who have also engaged in what they see as climate thought crimes, demanding all kinds of, you know, decades of their paperwork and science and emails, all kinds of things. And this is who they're after. You know, Exxon, if they can make a kind of public example out of Exxon or maybe get it to settle and pay some money to them for their states, they would love that. But what they really want to do is go after these 100 groups who are think tanks and public policy outfits that are very influential and shut them down. Because And why are they doing all this? Because guess what? They can't win the climate debate with the public. Despite 10 years of getting up every day and saying we've got to pass a giant climate change program through the Congress, they've never got anywhere even close to 40 votes in the Senate, which is why the president has now decided that, you know, he was going to implement it by executive fiat. And it's why they feel the need to simply jail or shut up anyone who doesn't agree with them.
Kim, you wrote, quote, "The intimidation game is real, and it is now a defining feature of today's political environment. Americans tend to worry about Washington gridlock and political dysfunction and rampant partisanship. Their greater worry ought to be the steady erosion of their own rights," end quote. Would you share with us one of the ideas you provide in the book on how we can do so?
Yeah, so first of all is speak out, as we were talking about. But I think another thing that comes through really clear in this book that we all need to rethink is, in fact, our current disclosure regime. We tend to think of happy things when we hear the word disclosure and transparency. It's meant to be about good government. One of the problems, though, is that our disclosure regime has been utterly turned on its head. It's supposed to be there to allow citizens to keep track of what's going on in government and, as a result, to keep corruption out of government. But all you have to do is look at Hillary Clinton's server disaster to know that government has become exceptionally good at evading all of those requirements. She has her private server. You can't get any documents out of the Obama administration. Computers crash. Documents are lost. You know, it's very difficult to keep tabs. On the other end, though, what has happened is it's instead been entirely trained on the citizens themselves, allowing government to keep track of who citizens are, what causes citizens are involved in, and what things they believe in, which is one of the ways in which the government is then able to go after them and exact retribution. So I think we need to rethink, for instance, the threshold levels at which people have to acknowledge that they gave a donation. Right now, it's still $200. I can promise you, living and working in Washington, there is no federal politician who can be bought off for $200. But there are a lot of people who give slightly more than that who can be intimidated. I think we, you know, also just need to rethink, for instance, or be on guard against, for instance, attorney generals out in California and New York who are both attempting to force nonprofits in their states to now reveal their list of donors, which are currently, by the way, protected under law, protected in Washington. But, you know, these attorney generals, Kamala Harris and Eric Schneiderman, they want it. They don't want it because they want cleaner or better government. They want those lists so that they can know who to go after. So we've got to be a little bit more aware and rethink disclosure.
If you're just joining us, our guest this segment has been Kimberly Strassel, author of the new book, The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. Kim, what's next for you, and how can we continue to follow your work?
Well, next is back to the day job, which is, you know, what I do. I write a column every week for the Wall Street Journal under my name called the Potomac Watch column. I write a lot of the editorials that appear on the page. I'm a member of their editorial board. I tend to spend a lot of time trying to write about abuses like what are put together in this book, The Intimidation Game. And I'm going to stay on the lookout for it, too, because, as I said, there are examples of this mounting every day, and it might be worthwhile writing something more on it in the end.
That's right. Excellent. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me.
Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/AACONS and choose from over 180,000 audio programs. Download a free title and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audibletrial.com/AACONS. That's audibletrial.com/AACONS and get started today. Why Audible? Audible content includes more than 180,000 audio programs from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. You can get books from some of your favorite ACONS guests, including Alan West, Guy Benson, Kirsten Powers, Peter Schweitzer, and others. So go to audibletrial.com/AACONS today.
Kim R. Holmes is a distinguished fellow and former vice president of the Heritage Foundation, who oversaw the think tank's defense and foreign policy team for more than two decades. He also served as a United States Assistant Secretary of State for International Organizational Affairs during most of the first term of President George W. Bush from 2001 to 2004. His new book is entitled The Closing of the Liberal Mind: How Groupthink and Intolerance Define the Left. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Marie.
You're very welcome. Recently, it's been alleged by former employees that Facebook is limiting conservative opinions on its site. And New York City Mayor de Blasio has requested that there be a boycott of Chick-fil-A, a company so Christian that it refuses to open for business on Sundays because of that company's Christian view on marriage. Your book is then well-timed. You wrote, quote, "American liberals are becoming increasingly illiberal. They are surrendering to the temptations of the closed mind," end quote. How great is the problem of illiberalism today, and why is it increasing?
Well, I think we have to start first with some definitions of these words. If you ask the average person what liberal-minded means, and I'm put aside for a moment the categories of progressivism and all of that, but a liberal-minded person is somebody who's open to debate, keeps an open-minded about ideas. They will reach a conclusion and have principles, but they believe that everybody has a right to their opinions. And particularly in the public square, and the force of law should never be used to deny people their freedom of expression, their freedom of conscience, or any of their constitutional rights for that matter. And then you have the public debate or the political debate within those parameters and that framework. The problem of illiberalism is the opposite of what I just said. It's using either public shaming rituals, you know, shouting people down in the public square, or using the force of law or some kind of coercion to deny people their freedom of speech, expression, and conscience. Illiberalism, as the opposite of liberalism, this kind of method I just described, it can exist ideologically on the right or the left. It can exist in authoritarian regimes like in places like Russia or in China. But the thing is that for most Americans, they don't realize or don't normally associate this kind of coercive illiberalism with the left. It's usually associated with the right. And I wanted to point out in my book, The Closing of the Liberal Mind, that this is a mistake. That as a matter of fact, what you see happening on our campuses with freedom of expression and freedom of speech being denied, and other examples that we can talk about in the interview, there's a blind spot on the part of many Americans, particularly many progressives, about how their ideology is being used to deny people their rights, their freedom of expression, and their freedom of speech.
In your book, The Closing of the Liberal Mind, you also used the term, quote-unquote, postmodern left. What mm-hmm. is the postmodern left? Are they different from what we would normally call progressives?
Yes, they are. I mean, they're similar, but they're different. There's three phases that I describe in the book of the history of progressivism over the last 120 or 30 years. First phase was progressivism of the late 19th century and the early 20th century, people like Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson. The modern progressive movement began then. The second phase was the 1960s with the rise of the New Left, where you had sort of radical ideas of cultural revolution imported from Europe, mainly from the neo-Marxist Frankfurt School that fused Freudianism and Marxism to talk about sexual revolution, cultural revolution, that gave rise to identity politics and the culture wars that we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years. And since the 60s, this is the third phase, it's what I call the postmodern phase. Postmodernism is just a fancy word for essentially radical relativism, both ethically and even epistemologically, in terms of doubting whether or not there is such a thing as truth, either a physical truth or biological truth or an ethical truth. And these ideas that manifested themselves in the multicultural movement, particularly the more radical versions in the law schools and the humanities departments, the English and language departments in our universities over the last 40 years, they introduced into that new left ideology of identity politics this notion of sort of radical relativism. And that enabled the what I call the postmodern left to develop a very slippery identity. On the one hand, they seem to be all about groupthink and equality in terms of identity politics, whether it's gender or race or whatever the case may be. But particularly in the area of sexual politics, it really becomes a kind of radical individualism, a kind of expressiveness, almost bordering on narcissism in some cases, of about whatever a person desires in their own private minds becomes the legal framework for everyone else to have to conform to in the name of equality. And that's the postmodern element of it. And I describe this in the book because I just, when I started studying this, I just thought this is something that I think a lot of people are missing, not only conservatives, but frankly, many people who identify themselves as liberals. And it makes it not only ideologically slippery, but frankly, quite successful politically. Because one of the reasons why I think the progressive left has been successful over the last 20 or 30 years is that because it combines this idea of equality with a radical idea of individual satisfaction, that whatever I say I need or want, that's the end of the story. And that appeals to a lot of mm-hmm. people. And somehow making that an issue of equality, whether it's the same-sex marriage debate or it's transgenderism, was politically a brilliant stroke because it just confuses some people because they don't know what they're dealing with. They don't know if they're dealing with individualism or equality. And the fact of the matter is postmodern left, and they want you to assume that the two things are exactly the same.
You make the case in The Closing of the Liberal Mind that illiberalism is in many ways antithetical to liberalism. How so?
Well, as I said at the outset, classic liberalism is about individual rights, which are to be defended by the government. And in the United States, that is, of course, the Bill of Rights. And the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights is freedom of speech and freedom of religion. And so the government was constituted to defend the individual rights of all Americans, regardless of their race, their gender, sexual orientation, whatever. They were to be treated equally before the law as individuals. That's the classic liberal idea, and the government should be have checks and balances on it to the extent that it doesn't infringe on the individual rights of individuals. Where you get illiberalism, or where you get the different kinds of sort of semi-authoritarianism I'm talking about in the book, is when you start developing the idea of equality based upon group rights. In other words, you are, as an individual, whether you're a woman or a black person or somebody who is identifies a man identifying as a woman, you get your rights, your civil rights, exclusively on the membership in that group. And so therefore, what normally would unite individuals in the body politic, which would be everybody is individually the same, we start slicing and dicing differences of what our rights are based upon our membership in that group. And therefore, at that point, it's the role of the law and the government to oversee and define what that system is. And it's very alien from the way the Constitution was set up in this country and the way the law was practiced for over 250 years. And it's opened the door for some very serious challenges, not only of freedom of speech, but freedom of conscience, particularly freedom of religious conscience, and the debate over same-sex marriage and the like. It's getting to the point where many people involved in that debate are saying if you even question it in the public square, you can be fined. If you're a pastor who doesn't want to preside over a same-sex marriage ceremony, you can either be fined or ostracized. And that means that you are challenging directly their freedom of conscience, particularly in the public square.
One illiberal characteristic of the postmodern left you mention is that of racial stereotyping. You write, quote, "The postmodern left turns the civil rights model on its head. It embraces racial stereotyping, racial identity by any other name, and reverses it, transforming it into something positive, provided the pecking order of power is kept in place," end quote. Is the postmodern left movement essentially racist then?
I think one of the beauties of Martin Luther King Jr.'s approach to civil rights was it was grounded in the whole idea of the Declaration of Independence and the original classic liberal idea of the American founding. That was why he was so successful, and I think it was brilliant politically and brilliant morally. And that was is that he said that black people as individuals were equal to white people because they are individuals. And so he instinctively was rebelling against the idea of stereotyping all black people as the same, and so it was a rejection of the stereotype based upon the classic liberal idea of individual rights. So it was completely within the history of modern classic liberalism. The problem with the postmodern left is, as you rightly said, is they turn it on its head. And at this point, people get their rights, as I said a minute ago, from their membership of being in a group. And it's usually a group that's deemed to be oppressed. And so, therefore, you create regulatory and legal regimes to try to manage that. And so it is a stereotyping not only of white people who are supposed to be, based upon white privilege, racist by definition, but also start stereotyping the way all black people are supposed to act, and assuming, for example, they all vote the same way, they have all the same attitudes politically. And so what starts out seemingly to be a way of defending people ends up in a kind of stereotypical division of or vision of people based upon their group membership or their race. So to answer your question, is it essentially racist? No, it doesn't start out that way. It's not as if I don't think in many cases, although I do think, I will say, I think some activists actually are quite racist. But as a movement, I don't think it starts out that way. But the problem is that they're a prisoner of their constructs. They're a prisoner of their ideology. And once you start going down this road of thinking that you're going to defend all racial minorities by carving out special protections for them and then assuming that anybody who questions that is by definition racist, sometimes that's called reverse racism. I don't particularly like that term. But once you go down that road, you're going to start stereotyping people, everybody, not just white people, but black people too. And I think that the classic liberal way of looking at people is to look at them as individuals and judge people not on the color of their skin, but the content of their character, as Martin Luther King Jr. said.
In 2010, Mary Frances Berry, a prominent liberal activist and former U.S. Commission on Civil Rights chairman, said of the Tea Party on Politico.com, quote, "Tainting the Tea Party movement with the charge of racism is proving to be an effective strategy for Democrats. There is no evidence that the Tea Party adherents are any more racist than any other Republicans, and indeed many other Americans. But getting them to spend their time purging their ranks and having candidates distance themselves should help Democrats win in November. Having one's opponent rebut charges of racism is far better than discussing joblessness, end quote. With this in mind, how much of illiberalism, such as it's denouncing anything and everything with which progressives disagree, is based upon sincere belief, and how much of it is, as Barry framed it, a tactic to suppress opposing thoughts?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, I'm sure that you find a lot of activists in the Democratic Party and other groups allied to the Democratic Party who do see it as a very useful tactic. I mean, after all, everyone knows that if you go out in a public square and accuse somebody of racism, just the accusation alone is enough to taint them. And so if they're spending all their time trying to explain why they're not that way, they've already lost the debate. So Democrats and liberal activists have discovered this tactic a very long time ago to be very useful. But I do also think that some of the ideologues and some of the intellectuals involved in the postmodern left have pretty much convinced themselves that, for example, that all white people are culturally and even other ways just essentially racist just because of who they are. This notion of white privilege was invented in the universities to explain this. And the problem is that it erases all individual moral responsibility and authority for the whole idea of racism. If an entire race is responsible for racism, then what's the responsibility of an individual who actually goes out and commits a racist act? In the old way of seeing things, that individual could be held accountable for an ethical and even illegal act. But if it's a racial issue, if either through history, culture, or biology, or whatever the case may be, if everybody's, quote, a little bit racist, if you're a white person, then where's the moral culpability? I just think that's a very dangerous concept, because not only can it be thrown back in the face of somebody on the other side of a racial debate, it's also just completely contrary to the whole notion of the American Constitution of holding individuals accountable and responsible for their own ethical and moral decisions. And that's the very basis of the rule of law. And if we go down this route of trying to create special social and political categories where groups of people are responsible for the decisions of individuals, then everything is turned upside down as far as the law is concerned, and you're heading down the road towards authoritarian regimes.
You wrote on climate change that, quote, the intent could not be clearer. The state should suppress any questions about the reliability of climate change findings or data. In other words, a court should be invited to silence one side of a public policy debate, end quote. In fact, in no area of disagreement do conservatives have wishes of imprisonment tossed at them as often as in the debate over climate change. Why have liberals taken such a strong interest in this subject?
Well, it goes back to the 1960s and where there was the rise of the environmental movement, early 60s. There was a group called the Club of Rome and other environmental activists back in that decade that discovered that environmentalism was a very popular way, a popular new way to go after capitalism and the free market system from a new and different angle. So environmentalism has been a cause of the left now for decades. And so climate change is only the latest sort of permutation of that. In the 1970s, it was the opposite. They were worried about nuclear winter and the climate becoming too cold. And now it's the opposite. So as a part of the political movement of the left, it's not all that new. But why has it taken off in the last decade or so, or last 20 or so years? That's because literally billions of dollars have been invested by governments, mainly European governments, increasingly our own, into advancing this agenda. And climate change is just an agenda, really, to try to create more control of the economy through the regulatory state. It's a very popular and convenient way of doing it. And as a result of it, it's become orthodoxy. the concern I have in my book is not so much the debate over whether global warming exists or doesn't exist. It's actually more of a concern that the state, that liberals are using the state to actually deny anybody the possibility of disagreeing with anything in climate change orthodoxy. There is this recent example of the Attorney General out of the U.S. Virgin Islands issuing subpoenas against private organizations, demanding they turn over their keep in mind, these are private groups, these are private researchers, turning over all their information to prove that they're not committing some kind of a fraud on climate change because they're somehow being bought off by the energy companies, trying to use the model that was used against the tobacco industry and trying to make climate change, for example, a health issue. So it's a very imaginative way. It's very successful, at least as far as mobilizing people on the left. But the interesting thing is if you look at the public opinion polling in America, climate change is not all that important to most Americans. As a matter of fact, over the last 4 or 5 years, a lot of Americans are actually growing skeptical about even whether it exists or not. And I think a lot of that is a backlash against some of these extreme tactics that the left has been using in promoting climate change.
Those of us who follow websites like collegeinsurrection.com have long gotten used to the stream of headlines illustrating illiberalism on our college campuses. As we speak, for example, College Insurrection tells of conservative minority students being targeted at Claremont, a Harvard law professor writing that conservative Christians should be treated as harshly as the Germans and Japanese after World War II, and conservative columnist and former guest of ours, Jason Riley, being disinvited to speak at Virginia Tech for his views. You wrote, quote, "Knowledge, like human progress, must be created and managed by state policy, bureaucratized and forced on all people equally despite the infinite differences that exist between individual human beings," end quote. Is this why illiberalism is so active in academia?
I think it is. Unfortunately, the academic world over the last 50 or 60 years has become a place of stifling intellectual conformity. It's no longer really mainly about education, at least in the social sciences and humanities and those kinds of studies. Engineering and science, with the exception of climate change research, has pretty much been left alone. But it's over the last 50, 60 years, the new left of the 1960s has been marching through the institutions of America, and the main institutions it's been marching through is the university and the college system, and even the primary and secondary schools. And that's because many of these people back in the 60s realized if you control what people think, you can control what they do. It's kind of go for the hearts and minds first, and everything else will follow. And so, unfortunately, our education system is not about education anymore. Very often it's about indoctrination. And this has become mainly not only the place the universities have to become a place that creates these ideas of the postmodern left that I'm describing in the book, but also actually the professors go out and become activists rather than teachers, political activists, like a Harvard professor that you mentioned. And there are scores of other like that. And you can just every day it pops up where another university professor is out doing something outrageous, trying to deny somebody their rights. And this is a very sad because on the one hand, the university is supposed to be a place for open discourse and education, but it's also very sad because it's where these ideas, these illiberal ideas that I described, are being created. And they make their way into the popular culture through, through journalism, through this primary and secondary schools. They eventually work their way into the entertainment industry, and eventually, as they are now, the corporate boardrooms. And so it's like the universities are like an incubator of radical ideas, and it's been quite successful, because today they pretty much are in sync with the popular culture of America. But on the other hand, we're paying a terrible price because, as I say in the book, the liberal mind is closing. They're not interested in debate. They can't imagine anything outside of the framework of their own intellectual constructs. And if you start disagreeing with them, they just start calling you names, to dismiss what you have to say, and we'll just simply will not engage. It's kind of like an intellectual discourse or debate on the level of Twitter. That's pretty much the way you find yourself in the. And that's actually on a good day. On a bad day, if a conservative goes onto a university campus like Jason did, or like some of my friends, they'll end up in a closet somewhere or a bathroom with security protecting them from people who actually mean them physical harm. And this is absolutely ridiculous. It's closer to what you would see with the Red Guard during the Cultural Revolution in China in the 1960s. Where student brigands were going around threatening people. And this is very dangerous, very dangerous.
You wrote, quote, "The left's intolerance raises a question. Is progressive liberalism becoming totalitarian? Is the illiberalism described here turning that movement into something downright dangerous? A lot of conservatives think so," end quote. What is your view?
Yeah, I think that it's certainly become more authoritarian. I mean, we're dealing here with specific words that have historical meaning. Totalitarianism was, of course, used to describe Nazi Germany and the communist system in the Soviet Union, where the state had absolute and total control. And I think that as historical examples, many progressive liberals are not there. They don't want to go that far. The problem is that on the fringes of the movement, particularly in the universities and some of the activists who are more true believers and more dedicated to doing what I described a minute ago and trying to shut down debate in college campuses and the like, or abusing the law to try to get your way on climate change, they are getting awfully close to an authoritarian mindset of using government power and the law to control what people think and say and to die people of their constitutional rights. Now, is that totalitarian? Well, it gets awfully, awfully close because you're trying to control the total of a person, the totality of a person. If you insist on controlling what they say and think, it's no accident that the freedom of speech is in the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. It's because all the other rights that the Constitution is supposed to protect are based upon the freedom of conscience and freedom of speech. And so you tread on that very, very lightly. Otherwise, you're going down a very dangerous road. And I just feel that the postmodern left and many people who are either sympathetic to them or are silent when they go too far are getting dangerously close to a new kind of authoritarian mindset that is not only fundamentally illiberal, but also actually is undermining even the agenda of the progressive movement itself.
Is the amazing rise of Donald Trump's political career related to the rise of illiberalism?
Absolutely. It's a reaction to it. It's a little bit of a fight fire with fight fire attitude. It's a bit of a reaction to what people call political correctness. In other words, the more outrageous a student or a faculty member of a university acts in trying to shut down speech, the people on the receiving end feel that they have just been given permission to go out and act in the same way. And so I think that the illiberalism I'm describing here, and I think also, frankly, the overreach of President Barack Obama has created a backlash, a cultural backlash in this country. A lot of people feel not only economically disenfranchised, but culturally and even morally disenfranchised. And they're looking around for some savior, and some of them are seeing Donald Trump. I'm put aside whether or not he is their savior or not. That's not what I'm dealing with. But I'm saying that there's no way to explain the rise of Donald Trump if we hadn't gone through what's happened with the postmodern left over the last 25 or 30 years.
If you're just joining us, our guest this segment has been Kim Holmes. His latest book is entitled The Closing of the Liberal Mind, How Groupthink and Intolerance Defines the Left. What's next for you, and how can we continue to follow your work?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I very much enjoyed the conversation. If you would like to order the book, go on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. Or even to a Barnes & Noble store and put in my name, Kim R. Holmes, and The Closing of the Liberal Mind, and you can order the book there. or you can go to heritage.org, which is the Heritage Foundation think tank where I work, and you can follow my work there as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement. Please join us at www.AfricanAmericanConservatives.com. There you'll find information about our Twitter feed, Facebook page, and our blog. All opinions expressed here are those of this show and our guests. Copyright African American Conservatives.